Welcome to Insight Aviation, helping you to take a look inside the world of captains, aerospace professionals, air traffic controllers, and much more. Learn how they got started, where they are now, and their advice for aspiring aviators. This series is brought to you by Wayman Aviation Academy. Learn to fly with a safe, reliable, professional academy, located between Miami and Fort Lauderdale in sunny South Florida, USA. Enjoy the training and cosmopolitan life with Wayman's 42 aircraft, 6 airline partners, and 2 bases to help you be the captain. Hello, and welcome to Insight Aviation. We are a podcast and YouTube series here to bring you aviation professionals, give you their insights into the aviation world, the industry, how they came to be where they are. You can find us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram under Wayman Aviation. And of course, you can like and subscribe to the Insight Aviation podcast now on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. For those of you that are joining us here live in the Zoom or with us on Facebook Live, please drop a note in the chat. I'd love to know where you're coming from. You know, are you here in Miami with us? Are you coming to us from Peru or Delhi or wherever it might be? We tend to have a pretty diverse audience. So thank you all for joining us. So let us know in the chat or in the comments on Facebook where you're coming to us from. I have the distinct pleasure today of introducing you all to a very experienced pilot that I've had the opportunity to know here in South Florida as a very charitable volunteer in aviation. Our pilot here, Edwin Garcia, hello.
Everybody.
Give us a little idea. What are you doing today? What is your role?
Today at United Airlines, I'm a first officer in the Boeing 757 and 767 fleet. Going on year 6. This is my 6th year as of March.
Wow, that's exciting.
I almost didn't make it last year, right?
It was a tough year. We're definitely going to be talking about that.
Going on year 6, mainly the 75 and 76, we flew an even split between Europe, domestic, Hawaii, and a little bit of South America. Nowadays, we're doing a lot of Hawaii and waiting for Europe to open up again so that we can resume our normal schedules into Europe.
So which routes did you mostly fly? Did you ever pick a line and stick with it?
Yeah, you know, I really tried to have it all. And by that, I mean I wanted days off. I wanted to take it easy. And I wanted money. So I would trade. We can trade trips. It's like you saying to your coworker, I'll work for you today. You work tomorrow for me, things like that. So we could trade trips and drop trips and request trips on our schedule. And so most of the time, I would chase the Europe stuff. I would chase the IRO position, the international relief officer. Ah. And in that flight, we have 3 crew members. So it's not such an exhausting flight. It is an exhausting trip, but not a flight. And and that's what I would do. Once I saw I needed more practice flying, you know, stay current, then I would go for domestic stuff and try to mix it up a little bit. So my average month was 2 trips domestic, 2 trips international, try to mix it up.
That's interesting. I'd love to hear more about the aviation lifestyle, but I'm going to switch it up today. We talked about our kind of our basic format, but I think I'm going to bring the newsworthy items to the front.
Okay.
We are so newsworthy, and I'm sure that everyone's joining us on Facebook and in the Zoom wants to know, because United is like all over the news this week. Like I can't, like every time I open up my phone, it's like United's doing this, United's doing that. The most recent, of course, is this large aircraft purchase. Now, I know as a first officer, you're probably not in the command center, like ordering airplanes, but what's the chatter amongst the pilots?
Well, this was an opportune time for you to invite me to this and the news happening, good news, thankfully, about the airline, because one of the things we have to do as pilots is stay abreast of what our company's doing, not be all up in their business, but at least know what's going on and things are good or bad, what's going on with the business. And so this aircraft order was announced as one of the biggest in a few years. And it's one of several that we have placed, that the airline has placed, split between the 710, 737s and the Airbus A321neos. And their intention is to start replacing some of our older aircraft, the narrow body, what we call single aisle aircraft that are used for domestic stuff, replacing some of the CRJ200s that are used in the regionals and start using more of the 737s. We don't have a replacement in line for the 757, which is a very useful aircraft for Western Europe and some reaches in South America. So the A321 might fill that gap until there's a replacement or they decided the 737 is going to be one used for parts of Europe.
So you think it's mostly, so it's a very large order. So it's mostly a replacement order, kind of getting rid of old fleet and bringing the upgrade, which increases capacity?
Yes. What I understood from yesterday's meeting was it's a mix of upgrades, upgauging aircraft, and also growth, because we've been experiencing growth for the past few years. Ever since I was hired, I'll talk about is the potential. 2020 was a year where everybody stagnated and, you know, dropped fear into all of us. But now that time is passing and we're back into the growth mode. We have always had one of the largest routes, international structures, thanks to Pan Am routes. And so we have to feed those systems, 777s. We have more wide bodies than most others. And we have to make that happen with the growth. We have, what was it? South African routes. We have Croatia.
Oh, wow. That's
we're doing some neat stuff this year. I was just reading about it. It was actually South Africa, Iceland. We always go there every year, I've noticed. Greece and Croatia. Croatia is a new one for us.
I've heard beautiful things about Croatia. I haven't been able to make it out myself. It seems like there was one year, like maybe two, 3 years ago, where like three of my neighbors went to Croatia. I'm like, what's happening in Croatia?
I didn't know Croatia existed till somebody I know went to vacation there.
Right. That's interesting. So, it's got to be an exciting time for you. Do you think there'll be a change to your line, the 7576 line?
Yes, actually, I was pretty excited. Luckily, my fleet was the one that is assigned to Dubrovnik, Croatia.
Right.
And so there was an open trip. It was a dream, a pipe dream, but there was an open trip this month to Croatia. So in normal times, I could aspire to be in one of those flights and get to go to Croatia for the first time. It happened to me, I think it was 2019. I got to go to Prague.
I love Prague.
Well, we momentarily flew to Prague for the summer. I got to go to Prague.
Yeah. What a beautiful town. Like, I guess, I don't know if you know the story, but like all the bars are like two stories underground because the river floods up.
No, I didn't know that. I stay out of the bars when I travel.
That's true. You're a pilot. I'm sorry. I was backpacking, right?
No, but that's interesting.
It's interesting because whenever you go, out to have a drink, you actually go two stories underground is where most of those are. And they're like deep cellars. It feels like you're going to vampire world. It's also very old towny.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah, and that's one of the things about the layovers. You want to maximize your useful time, your time awake, but you also have to rest. So doing research like what you mentioned, now knowing that if I go somewhere, I always make sure to read up about it and try to get into something, because as far as I get is walking on foot. And I got to see the statue of Franz Kafka in the square. That's a pretty neat stuff.
Yeah, it is a beautiful town. Beautiful town with a big cathedral right in the middle. But coming back to what everyone wants to hear about, right? So the 7576 line, will it be impacted by this aircraft purchase?
Unfortunately, the 75 and 76 are the aging aircraft in the company. Every aircraft reaches its limit as far as how long it can operate due to cost of maintenance. Technology advances so fast that the engines are no longer as efficient as the new ones. So our fleet is the what they call the dying fleet, quote unquote. And I'm very happy to be on it while it's still there. And yes, it will one day wind down. The 757-200s are the first ones in line to be retired. And then the 300s and then the 767s. But those days keep getting pushed around. I think the pandemic really affected the retirement outlook because they saw the utility in these aircraft. Mm-hmm. We have so many different aircraft, everyone for certain missions. And when you bring these back, they come in useful. They just push back their retirement, but definitely 757s are on the chopping block.
So opportunity there maybe for you to be to get a 777 or a 787 type in the future. Very interesting.
Yeah. My dream is to be a captain on the 757, even if it's just one day as a reserve captain to sit in that seat of that beautiful plane. I'll be happy. But yeah, I think I'm going to end up chasing more wide body stuff. Sure. and enjoy more international things.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's something funny because we are in a very international place. You're in South Florida with us also. And there's a different mentality from people that come from the Miamis and New Yorks and Los Angeles, because we live in very international places. I have no, what is it? Spirit. I was told actually Spirit, because Spirit uses Fort Lauderdale as a big jump off for South America. And a lot of the U.S. domestic pilots that are from Chicago and Oklahoma and those places, they want to fly the domestic routes. And so they don't really want to fly the South American routes. Meanwhile, the Miami boys here are like, yeah, send me to Colombia, send me to Lima, send me to wherever.
Yeah. And it's a cultural thing. If people come from secluded areas of the U.S., for example, they grow up with a different mindset as far as exploring and what is around them. Some people break out of that, which I'm very happy to see at my airline. And yeah, we come up with people from so many different cultures and ways of thinking and viewing things and expressing themselves, that that's one great thing about living in Miami and flying for airlines that fly internationally.
Mm-hmm. So the other big news that came out of United this month was supersonic, cross-continental transatlantic travel, right? Like, United seems pretty serious about it. I don't think it's really a publicity stunt or a crapshoot. I mean, what's your feel on it? What have you heard?
I as well do not think it's a publicity stunt. I don't believe in using that term very often because companies really put a lot of thought into what they do. Our CEO, Scott Kirby, got us through 2020 along with the union. We came together to find a solution. And I have to give them credit because they really are thinking ahead, farther ahead than I would concern myself and other airlines obviously are thinking. I think this whole supersonic flight thing is more than just a show. You know, it's something that they want to see come to fruition. And depending on the economics, whether you believe it in it or not, is besides what I take into consideration. I really think that this is going to happen. I'm more of a wait and see kind of person. And so I'll believe it fully when I see it. But at the moment, I do believe it's a good idea. It's definitely something somebody would purchase. So yeah. Why not try it? And somebody's got to lead the way. Mm-hmm. And I'm happy to be part of an airline that is leading the way in a few things. And one of them is supersonic flight.
It is very exciting. Talk about pushing the envelope, right? It's something that I think the Concorde enamored everybody, but it was ahead of its time. And so maybe now with the new technologies, engine efficiencies, infrastructure to support it more and more so around the world, we might see our supersonic jet port here at TNT come back.
Yeah, I remember that was the whole reason for that airport, right? Absolutely. It was a supersonic jet port.
Yeah, those of you that don't know, we're in South Florida, and there's this huge runway. I want to say 8,000, 9,000 feet. I wish I had the chart in front of me right now. It's this one long runway in the middle of the Everglades, halfway between Miami and Naples. And it was supposed to be a supersonic jet port. And the Concorde didn't make its run, and environmental things kind of put a damper on it. And so we get to use it for training. Like, I love going out there doing approaches and touch and goes, especially on the multi. But it's one of those gem history items of South Florida.
Right? It's nearly 10,500 feet, Eddie.
10,500. It is a significant. Yeah, it was built for the Concorde.
Yeah.
So that's a lot of runway. Yeah. Yeah, can't go wrong. I do engine outs and things like that there on the runway, you know, because you got plenty of runway. You come back and you can still take off.
Yeah, I remember doing my instrument approaches, and I remember using it a few times during training.
Yeah, I think every pilot in South Florida has their TNT story, right?
Oh, you just reminded me of mine, so I'll tell you when the time comes.
Well, now's as good a time as any.
Well, no, if you were going to ask about how I got here and...
Let's start there. All right, pull me back to my own format. So
I like to freestyle too.
I always like to ask, how did you get even interested in aviation?
Well, I immigrated from Nicaragua when I was between 6 and 7 years old. Mm-hmm. Like most South Florida immigrants, I came straight to Miami. Sure. I didn't have anything to think about. I was a kid, immigrated here. Luckily, though, we ended up living in Miami Springs. You're familiar with that city. It's right across from the airport. And back then, we didn't have that concrete wall. Mm-hmm. Back then, I could see all the DC-10s and MD-11s parked for Million Air, mm-hmm. all the freighters, the coffin. What do they call it? That corner of the airport where the aircraft go to rust away.
Oh, yeah, when they tear them down.
Yeah. So I used to be able to see like the DC-10s, and I was just very curious about these DC-10s, these massive machines mm-hmm. taking off. And I saw two windows in the front and these little windows compared to the size of the plane. And I saw two heads inside. I'm like, how in the world does that work? Like, that's just amazing. Look at the size of this machine. So that sparked my curiosity when I was about 9 years old living in Miami Springs.
You ever think now how you're the guy in that little window, but your plane's actually much larger than
I don't know. I don't know if it's larger than the DC-10.
That was a bit of a beast. I have to look that one up.
Oh, that one's an animal. Yeah, but every now and then, whenever I look outside the window and I think back, I said, wow, I'm that little person inside this window, this big machine. Because when you fly, you don't think about everything going on behind your door. Although it's on your mind, their safety, the people are alive in your aircraft. You don't think about the breadth of what you're doing. You're just in your little world. And so every now and then I do sit back and say, wow, I'm the person in that window. So that's how I became interested in aviation.
And just a little side note, I actually just looked it up here in the background. They're actually pretty close in line. The DC-10 with the 767, the 300, 180 feet long, the 767, and the DC-10, 182 feet long. They're about the same size.
Yeah, I the DC-10s and the 11s are just massive to me. When they tell me the numbers, I lose it.
Yeah.
And so when I became interested in aviation, I grew up in Miami Springs. I went to high school, middle school, elementary school in Miami Springs. But my break into aviation came when I was in high school. George T. Baker Aviation, one of my favorite institutions, has a program for teenagers in high school to share their time between high school studies and technical studies to become an A&P. So I took them up on that. In my junior year, I became a student in the airframe program. That's what I pursued. And I started learning about maintenance, general, and then airframe.
Wow. So did you have your airframe there when you graduated?
Oh, no, I never got it. I was such a chicken back then. I was such a chicken because, okay, I'm being told by all these adults, oh, you have to take a practical exam and you have to demonstrate knowledge. And I'm like, I'm 18 years old. I'm thinking, oh, that must be tough. Oh, I was nervous. I never took the test.
Oh, what about?
And I should have, because I love that stuff. And who knows how handy it would have come in. I intend to finish it one day, one way or another.
Sure. I call those a double threat. We actually have an excellent young man in our hangar right now, Ariel, who just came back with his A and P. He's 25. I think he's 25 years old. He's got his AMP and his private pilot license. He's working towards his commercial. When you can be both a pilot and a mechanic, I call you a double threat.
Yep. Yep. I know plenty of people who I actually have a colleague at United who was an A&P working and then moved on to flying. And I know a friend who is an A&P and owns a business and owns aircraft. You remember Lorenzo? Do you remember Lorenzo?
Sounds familiar.
Dreadlocks. Guy has a kind of a Caribbean accent.
I think so. Yes. Yes. I know exactly what
you're talking about. Him. Yeah, he'd be someone to know.
Great thing. And, you know, out of Opa-locka, where all those DC-3s fly, you have to be an A&P and a pilot to work with them, because if you get stuck in the Bahamas, you got to get yourself back. You got to fix it. So those guys to keep those flying.
Yeah, so I got into aviation in that avenue, thanks to George T. Baker Aviation. And when I graduated high school, George T. Baker Aviation had an apprenticeship program in the first time ever, they had an apprenticeship program with a company called Avborne Maintenance.
Oh, excellent. Avborne.
Yeah, Avborne, you remember them. And Avborne, I think, turned into AAR. They're now AAR. So every time I see that hangar, I remember when I started working as an A&P apprentice.
That's excellent.
And I was always saying to myself, I'm going to be a pilot one day, you know, but never really had a plan. I just thought about it, talked about it, never had a plan. Didn't know anybody, had no clue.
You were manifesting it. You were thinking.
Yeah, I was thinking, right? And then one day, we worked on 727 for UPS at that time. And so we closed up a 727 from UPS from a C check. And I guess the mechanics, my colleagues at the time, were remembering that I had said I wanted to be a pilot. So they invited me on the test flight of the 727.
Beautiful.
And I wish I could remember more, but I do remember that I got to sit in the jump seat for the first time and we flew to TNT.
TNT.
And that was where they did their approaches. And I was so wowed that I asked for a shift change to the evening so I could go to school in the daytime. They didn't approve it. I don't blame them. So I quit my job and went to Broward College.
Oh, excellent.
Full time. And just went to it. Didn't even think about it. Didn't think about losing a job, an opportunity, an apprenticeship. You know, I just said, I want to be a pilot. And I left.
You dove in head first.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it is like that. You know, clearly the bug was already there. But when it bites, it doesn't let go.
Yeah. It's like golf. Once you start, you can't stop.
No, watch out. and both pretty expensive hobbies, really. But so that's amazing. So Broward College was your next step. Now, you'd already had some George T. Baker under your belt, so you knew you would want to be in the aviation world. So I hear it so often. I grew up next to an airport, watching them land and take off, that inspiration. So you're going through this path, admittedly kind of stumbling through it a little bit, but you're getting there, right? So Broward College, and was that under Ursula when she was running it?
No, I remember another name. Woman. Jane.
Yeah, Jan Shakespeare.
Jan Shakespeare.
Yeah.
That was her.
Broward College, again, for everyone watching, has a wonderful aviation program, as is Miami-Dade College and Florida Memorial here in South Florida. There's some really nice aviation programs because South Florida is so aviation rich. But you chose Broward College, and how was that experience?
Yeah, and I chose Broward College because at the time I was living in the northern part of Dade County. Broward College,
sure,
20 minutes from me, the airport, everything was co-located. It was a perfect deal. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad I did. I enjoyed it a lot. At the time, the academy was called Calm Air.
Yes.
Later changed to Delta Connection Academy. And then after that, I graduated and left. But I'm glad I chose it. I didn't do my research. So I didn't know at the time what the difference was between 141 and 61. Sure. I had no clue. I just went in there and said, I want to be a pilot. Give me money. My mom gave me some money. And then I got a loan. But that's where the key came in. Going to a 141 school that was attached to a university or college facilitated a loan application because they saw it's a structured program. It's a curriculum. They saw that it was something serious, not just going to a 61 school asking for $30,000 and they have no clue what I'm doing with it.
That's true. That's a big deal. There's lots of small operators, independent instructors, small flight schools that operate under Part 61. For the most part, especially as a U.S. citizen, it doesn't really matter if you're 61 or 141, right? Where does it matter? If you're an international student, it has to be 141 by law. And almost, I'd say 99% of the college programs that I've seen are all 141 as well because of that, because of the structure, the rigor, the record keeping. And in that case, you can get federal financial aid or loans. We're very lucky right now here at Wayman Aviation to have that same thing. Because of the 141 program, we've got Meritize and coming soon, Sallie Mae loans. It's a big deal.
Oh, yeah, that's a huge help because I've run into so many students. We all have money issues. We need the money. And the other thing that you mentioned about 141 training was the structure. If I hadn't had that when I was younger with my personality, there's no telling what I would have done, not aviation, because they were very structured. They treated you like an airline pilot from day one. Their instructors are very professional. And that's why I like 141 schools like yours. Because you have to follow a curriculum and stick to it and do your best. You're being audited and all that. So that was another advantage of choosing the school that I did.
Yeah. You know, sometimes life presents itself to you in the right way, right? And even though you didn't do your research, you ended up where you needed to be.
Yeah, it's crazy how my life has worked out. I've just known people at the right times and I've done my part, but I attribute it mostly to other people.
So you did all your licenses with Broward College up to CFI?
Nope. I was looking through my logbook because I remember when I first set foot into Wayman Aviation was to take a written exam. You know, back then, your school in Opa-locka, I used to go in there for all my written exams.
Yeah, we've always had a testing center. Absolutely.
But I completed all the way to commercial at Broward College. And then that's when I realized, wow, I've spent a lot of money. So I started asking around and, you know, asking other pilots, and that's how I ended up at Wayman for my multi-engine training.
Ah, oh my gosh. I didn't know you even studied here with us.
Yeah, I did. I studied at multi. I remember the guy, he was an older gentleman. I hope he's still around. Older guy. He was old back then.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Shlomo is the first person that comes to mind. Shlomo Korn was our chief pilot right around the year 2000. And he flew right into his 80s until he couldn't get a medical.
Well, I obtained my multi-engine in 2005 with you guys.
So it could have been him.
Yeah.
Then he stepped back from chief pilot and was instructing. And I have to admit, you know, I was gone from the flight school for a good period there. I mean, 34 years. I've really been active with it for the last 12. Before that, you know, I was just another student or not even.
Yeah, you probably weren't thinking you'd be the man in charge of it one day, right?
I really didn't. But, you know, aviation in the blood, you can't get away from it. It kind of brings back in.
You guys have established a great legacy. I love what happened to it because I remember it. I remember it way back then. Yeah. So I became multi-engine rated at Wayman in 2005. And that's when I left the academy and I just started branching out. But I had loans to pay.
Sure.
You know, loans will come due one day.
Yeah.
So I took a couple of years off working in several office jobs. I was an office temp. I even became a private investigator, something that really interested me. But, you know, sitting in those offices, I remember that I wanted to be a pilot. And I got tired of clocking in and clocking out, being told when to eat, what I could do, when I could do, being monitored. I was like, oh, this stinks. So I, again, took a plunge. I went back to the bank, Wells Fargo. I found a new way to borrow money. And I borrowed more money and went for CFI and did my training at Opa-locka, another academy, another school you know about, Endeavor Flight Training.
Sure. Yeah.
I became a CFI there. And then I began working in about 2008 is what I noticed in my logbook. I began working as a CFI between Opa-locka Airport and North Perry Airport. And even though I was dragging my feet on becoming a CFI, like most people I run into, we don't want to do it. Let me tell you, the best thing I ever did for my career was to be a CFI.
Yeah. So tell us.
I can give you names and dates. Everybody I have met has been influential to me being here because I was a CFI. If I hadn't been a CFI, I would have never met any of these people.
Wow.
Yeah.
As in they were students or they were coworkers with you or?
They were, I'd say they were, some were students. I remember one, you know, Manny Camacho.
Okay.
He was, his son was a student of mine very brief period, but I met him and he was someone who recommended me for this career path here in United. And I just met people that all of them gave me either a lead on a job or recommended me for a job. And it was always the next step up for me because I kept in touch with these folks.
Well, aviation, I always say, is like the biggest industry, but the smallest community, right? So you keep coming across the same people over and over again. And when you take that step to insert yourself into, you know, that first aviation job, whether it's working as a flight instructor or towing banners or working the desk at a flight school or an FBO, when you're in the environment day in and day out, you can't help but meet all the regulars, right? And everyone, it's a very, I've never seen a place where in the aviation world where people were like not helpful, right? Where people were like, oh, you can't succeed because I'm going to succeed. There's plenty. There's plenty in the aviation world. So I see a lot of hands helping other people up the ladder.
Yeah, luckily in South Florida, we got such a mix of cultures where I think we're accustomed to being helpful to others regardless of anything about them. It's not like that all over the world, unfortunately, but we're lucky in that aspect here in South Florida. And I was very fortunate to just run into people. I think something you mentioned, we're not only in this environment, but we have to involve ourselves in this environment. Sure. You know, you could be that person who comes to the flight school, does their work, goes home. I was that guy. I was that guy at Delta Connection. I just wanted to be a 20-something-year-old having fun. You know, while everybody wanted to talk airplanes and their latest landing and how to do a soft field, I was not interested. I just flew and got out.
Okay.
But when I became involved walking the airport, you know, asking somebody, can I ask you about the airplane? It's not, you make friends and you have to really involve yourself in aviation in that way. So I missed out. Mm-hmm. I recognize that, but I did it just in time. I woke up and started participating. So you have to develop a personality.
Sure.
You're outgoing, you're friendly, you're engaging, you ask people for advice and you ask them for help.
So this is what led to your volunteerism and the organizations?
Yeah, in 2000 and I think when was I working at Ameriflight? 2012. So between 2012 and 13, I was working at Ameriflight flying the Metroliner.
Excellent.
PIC. Luckily, right out of Opa-locka, I didn't have to commute.
Oh, very nice.
And I was hanging out there. And you remember a man named Homer Randall?
Of course. Yeah, Homer.
So Homer Randall's in the break room and I'm trying to take my nap, you know. Homer Randall's in the break room and I'm like, who's this guy? And I start talking to him and he tells me about OBAP. Organization of Black Aerospace Professionals. And it was very timely because at the time I was a CFI certificate holder, but I wasn't practicing. So I had always thought about, hey, well, if I could donate my time to somebody learning to fly, this would be great. And OBAP presented me an opportunity to do that. With my knowledge and my history of aviation, I got to participate in their programs towards STEM education, towards motivating other pilots. And that's how I became a volunteer, because before that, it was just talk. I said I would volunteer, but I never did.
Yeah. So I preach the joint organizations, whether it's the 99s or OBAP or Latino pilots or this new Asian pilots group that I think recently started. But not just join. It's not just giving them your $5, $10, $20, right? But take a role, right? Join a committee. Help at an air show. Help at a career fair. Right? Because it's the people that show up to volunteer that meet everyone, right?
Yeah.
Like, go to a career fair, especially in aviation or at the career fair, you're going to meet everybody at all the other tables.
Yeah. And I'll get back to my story, but before I forget this, this is what brought me to where I am. Before I joined OBAP and the LPA, and before I became a true participant in helping and organizing and doing things where it was needed, I was just another pilot with the same qualifications, sometimes less, because there's some very educated people out there scholastically. And that's what really set me off. You know, one of the things that I remember from networking at these job fairs and conventions was that all the airlines were beating on this whole leadership thing.
Sure.
Leadership. Do you have leadership? Are you a leader? Blah, blah, blah. And we can walk the walk or talk the talk. So most people, they don't know how to talk. and walk, because they just say, oh, I am, but I say, don't talk about it, be about it. Show people that you're a leader. Mm-hmm. Volunteering did that. Yeah. Eddie needs a volunteer at Wayman to do something. Well, I'm in here. Next thing you know, Eddie's telling people about your initiative, what things you're doing.
Yeah.
This young man's a leader now. Mm-hmm. And that's how it goes. So volunteering really opened up doors for me. And it can do that for anybody else. You don't have to do it on the level that I have, on the scale that I did in the last couple of years. You just have to participate and people will help you out.
It's funny because I was actually talking about this morning. I dropped my kids off at school at summer camp. And I was talking about sitting in the classroom, like, don't sit in the last row. You might not want to sit in the front row, right? But sit in the middle or something like that, right? Just like, if you're up front, you're more likely to participate, to learn, to meet, to connect, you know? And so that doesn't mean you sign up for OBAP and you run for chairman right away, right? But, you know, sign up for a committee, you know, help out at a table at a career fair or something like that. And you start just doing that, you know, meeting people. And then what's more important about you, it's just as important about you meeting people is that other people are meeting you.
Yes. Right? Yes.
That's just as important, if not more so.
Yeah. It's publicity for you, for your resume.
Personal publicity.
I was laughing when you said that because I was the guy who sat in the back of the class all the time. Yeah. I was not interested in what I could study at home is what I always told myself, you know, mm-hmm. And I did. I spent many hours reading instead of listening to the professors.
Sure.
But you're teaching your kids very early on to participate, to be in there.
Yeah, it's fun. But you hit on two things there that I want to kind of circle back to, right? You spent some time at Ameriflag. You didn't just jump to United.
Yeah. So thanks to being a CFI.
Great organization. Yeah.
I'm sorry, it's breaking up. So I didn't know if I was interrupting you or not.
Go ahead.
So yes, thanks to becoming a CFI, I became a CFI in 2007. So I was in training from 2001 until 2007 when I finally was 100% into aviation. Hmm. So anybody that's taking a little long with their training or dilly-dallying, you know.
So you had a seven-year hiatus with a desk job?
7 years of working various jobs while being a flight student.
Hmm. Oh, okay. So great.
From the day I just started training private to the day I became a CFI, 6 years.
Wow.
Yeah. And so thanks to being a CFI, I met a student of mine whose father-in-law needed a pilot for his Piper Aerostar.
Okay, nice.
And so obviously every student back then wishes they could fly a multi-engine, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody wants multi-engine time. How do you get it? Do you buy it? I got a job offer thanks to that. And thanks to my networking at the airport to fly a Piper Aerostar. And that's how I started building multi-engine time. Mm-hmm. As a CFI, I worked two jobs.
Sure.
Actually three jobs because I had two schools and this job.
Wow.
And eventually I had to whittle that down. But when I left that job, I had accumulated 500 hours of multi-engine PIC.
Very nice.
Whereas my colleagues didn't have that much time unless they were MEIs.
Sure. But
500 hours would take them a while.
Yeah.
I had 500 hours and I was like, oh, wow. Okay. So I'm pretty good. I'm okay. But I had to shoot for something else. Right. And that's when one of my mentors and one of my ex-bosses told me, you are not going to get very far unless you move up, level up. He goes,
level up.
ATP, you have to get it. You have the hours, get an ATP. Mm-hmm. So I became an ATP rated pilot as well.
Excellent.
And that's when I could start working as a commercial pilot. As charter operators, they took me more seriously now. Not only did I have flight time, but I had an ATP certificate. Mm-hmm. And so I began flying Piper Navajo Chieftains out of Fort Lauderdale for a company called Sun Air.
Okay.
And I did that. It was insane amount of flying to Cuba and the Caribbean. It's nuts. And so again, another 600-700 hours of piston twin time.
Yeah.
Luckily, when I was flying the Aerostar, my boss at the time had acquired a PC-12, a Pilatus.
Oh, really? Nice Pilatus.
And so I was very fortunate to meet a female pilot who was an instructor in that aircraft. And she instructed me in that aircraft for a few hours.
Okay.
I was able to log it and learn it.
That's some turbine time.
Yep. And so there was a mechanic working at Sun Air who told me, hey, there's a company called Ameriflight. They fly turboprops. You should really look into this. You know, it's better for you. It's where you need to go. So I did. I looked up Ameriflight. I applied. I leveraged my experience as piston twin PIC, which I had nearly 1,200 hours of.
Wow.
And I leveraged this Pilatus instruction. And that's how I became a Metroliner captain at Ameriflight. And right away, I began flying PIC in the Metroliner. I got to see new routes, Mexico, more of the Caribbean, and more of the U.S. on the Eastern Seaboard. that time passed, I accumulated my 1,000 because if you remember, even back then, they were preaching 1,000 turbine PIC.
Sure.
We had 1,000 turbine PIC. So I said, okay, my goal was to get 1,000 and then look abroad. But I wasn't in a rush to leave because it was a great company.
Yeah, I've heard nothing but good things about it.
I loved them. And then sure enough, after a year, it was time to move on. And I began chasing jets, more jet time. Now I need turbine time, but in jets, I thought I need to find jet time. So luckily for years, I had been networking at the airports. I would show up with resumes. I would probably knock on your door when I was looking for a CFI job, but I know I knocked on a lot of charter operators' doors. Mm-hmm. Anybody at FXE, FLL, and Opa-locka that would give me 5 minutes, I would say hi, give them a resume, introduce myself. I did that for months on end, year after year. Sure. So never came to much because I was a low-time pilot still to them, and their insurance has requirements. So I couldn't do anything about that. But laying the groundwork for that in 2014 is when it paid off, because that's when I began contracting. And people that I had bothered for years, they knew my new resume was in their hands. They saw the time and they were like, they called me. And I said, hey, Citation, Gulfstream, Challenger, come fly. I need a contract pilot. We'll figure out this rating thing, blah, blah. And I started flying jets.
Excellent.
I got to see some great aircraft. My dream ones was the Challenger 604.
Beautiful plane.
And Gulfstream. I got to meet more people, corporate pilots, because back then I was all about corporate. I thought that's where I'm going to end up because of my resume, frankly. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, that's where I'm going to end up. I didn't have a college degree, so how can I get to an airline? And okay, but then it was time to get serious about finding a full-time job, right? Not just contract here or there. And that's when I got the opportunity to work for World Atlantic Airlines here in South Florida,
yeah,
flying MD-80s. Mm-hmm. And I was a second in command in the MD-80. Again, I had a goal. It was to spend the time here only as much time as I need, because I need to get the job that is for me, you know, something, a real big airline like United. So I was there for about a year and a half.
So there was a switch, something that happened, because you thought you were going to end up in the corporate world, and then you decided.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Thanks for reminding me about that. So I never thought I would end up at an airline. Certainly not United Airlines, because I didn't have the requirements, mainly the four-year degree, a bachelor's degree, which is a competitive requirement. A lot of people go through the work of attaining that. I didn't have it. When I saw flight time compared to others, PIC time compared to others, even though I had about 4,700 hours and most of it was PIC and I had my 1,000 turbine PIC, there's applicants that have a lot more than that. Sure. You know, applicants that come from fractionals and regionals, and they have a lot more PIC time. So I never thought I could make it to an airline. And one day I reached a point where I had to decide on a path. From networking, I got the job offer of my dreams in corporate aviation. At the time, it was flying for a very well-known person, great captain, great owner, more money than I had made up to that point. So I was like, wow, this is the opportunity I worked for years to obtain. But I was involved in OBAP, and I was around a lot of airline pilots, and I saw how happy they were with their jobs and their companies and everything they communicated. So I asked one of my mentors to give me some guidance on this job offer. And he said, there comes a point where you choose a path and you kind of are stuck in that path. So yeah, if you choose to go corporate now, likely you're going to be corporate for the rest of your career. If you choose to wait, try to go airline, likely you'll be airline for the rest of your career.
It's true.
So I weighed them, you know, and I was with a sad, heavy heart that I turned down the job offer in corporate and stayed committed to pursuing the airline career. And luckily, he was right about my chances, because 2 months later, I received the interview offer for United. So it all worked out.
Wow, that's quite a path. That's a very winding path. A lot of jobs to get to where you are. You know, I think people in the last, especially in the last 5 years of the pilot shortage, have become a little complacent about how, okay, you get your commercial license, you become a flight instructor, 1,500 hours, regionals, majors. And it's like this very clear path, right? But you happen to be in your moment prior to that pilot shortage really sinking its teeth into the industry, right? So you have to hack your way through it.
Yeah. And I didn't know what I was experiencing, because I didn't, like I said before, I was the guy who sat in the back of the class and left flight school and went straight home. I didn't know how bad the industry was back then. Mm-hmm. I was clueless, but to to my benefit, I was clueless. So nothing stopped me from getting money, giving it to a flight school, and just going through the paces of becoming certified in different things, because I was clueless. But I was laying the groundwork at a very bad time without, now I know this because I'm an adult, but without knowing that bad times don't last forever. And sure enough, now our industry is back on the upswing.
Yep.
And so my timing was right, which is why last year when people were calling me, asking me for advice about this or that, should they start training? I said, yes, absolutely start training. Do it now, because nothing lasts forever. Bad times and good times.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I mean, the industry is cyclical, and we've had some captains that, you know, are now about to retire, and they've told us about deregulation they went through. We have a great instructor right now, Captain Witcher, if you're watching, who worked for Eastern Airlines, right? He worked for Eastern Airlines back in the day. And when deregulation happened, Eastern Airlines went under, he became a corporate pilot flying Gulfstreams for the rest of his career, right? And so there's many different roads in aviation, right? Yes, airlines are what everyone thinks of when they think of a pilot, right? With the hat and the suitcase and the stripes walking down the terminal, right? But there's so many interesting niches in aviation, right? There's missionary flying, there's cargo pilots, you know, I know, you know, Sheik, he's like in Korea right now flying a 747.
So, oh, that's right. Yeah. I forgot what company he went to. I think it was Southern maybe.
Yeah. Yes. So there's all those different branches of aviation. And it's interesting that you really did scale. You worked your way up through those branches and had a nice variety of flying right before you got into it. And so a lot of people come to me right now, they're like, oh, but the airlines aren't hiring. Like, why should I bother? Because if you really want to be a pilot, I don't think you can be anything else, right?
Yeah, yeah. Once you get a few hours in you, 100 and something, you're invested. Your heart is in it. But also, once you see, if you obtain loans, once you see the loans come through, you say, well, what's going to pay me enough so that I can pay these loans, have a lifestyle that I want, establish a family, a fund of some sort, what's going to pay me enough? Yeah. Well, you have two choices. And I faced this choice in 2015 as well. I said, well, I can either continue down this path and see how far it gets me. But there comes a point where I have to decide I need to make a real living. Mm. I need to make money. So you always got to do something else, study something else, stay involved in something and have an escape plan. But this is not for the weak of heart. This career is going to test you.
It will. It absolutely will. The cyclical nature of aviation, it will. But let's take a moment on there, right? Because you mentioned collegiate degrees and having a degree for the majors. And I know that you were already at United and started studying for a college degree or continuing a college degree.
Yes, yes. When I was hired at United in 2016, I finally had the opportunity to afford everything I wanted to do. One of those was obtain a bachelor's degree. Mm-hmm. And I was fortunate to be hired without one. But now I said I have to get one. And so I began studying at Broward College again. I went back to my original school and I signed up for their cybersecurity bachelor's degree. Excellent. And so I've been studying the cybersecurity degree for the past 3 years. I'll be done next spring.
And I imagine there's probably a huge need for cybersecurity experts in the airline industry, right? So you're a double threat there.
All around. Cybersecurity is everywhere. Luckily, we have not seen cybersecurity news related to airlines specifically, but they also have to be sure to be secure because these bad actors want to be in everything.
Yeah. So this is something that comes up actually quite a bit. You know, people tell me, do you need a bachelor's degree to be a pilot? And I say, no, you don't need it to be a commercial pilot. But if you want to reach the majors, you're going to be expected to have that bachelor's degree, especially if you want to reach a level of leadership, like an assistant chief, a chief pilot, or anything like that. And so I always paint the picture, you know, you did Broward College, but Embry-Riddle, very popular, has its, what do they call it? Worldwide. They have its worldwide where it's almost entirely online. And our instructors have had great success, you know, while they were being instructors or even after they were instructors to kind of be on flights, layovers, close the hotel room door and do your homework, right? Are you that guy, like everyone's going for a meal? You're like, I got to do homework.
Sometimes I am. I balance it all. You know, I recognize I'm in a great position. I don't need to be in school because of my job, but I should be in school because of I don't know what the future holds. And I really love cybersecurity. So sometimes I do lock myself in, but for an hour or two, and then I join the crew later on or I go out on my own. But you have to find time for everything. Going back to this degree thing, it is a very competitive requirement. And a lot of people are not happy about it, but we have to look at it from the airline's perspective. Somebody that commits to earning a degree in 4 years and gets it done on time has traits that someone that takes 10 years does not. Now, there's considerations as to why this person took 10 years. You have a lot of explaining to do. Mm-hmm. So you want to ask yourself, do I want to have a lot of explaining to do to an airline recruiter, or do I want to meet their requirements and impress them without having to work as hard as others to prove that they're worthy?
Sure. No, it makes a lot of sense. I mean, it just shows the idea of a college degree. And I've been told it doesn't really matter what your degree in is. It just shows that you have the dedication to master a subject, you know, outside of the basic skills of flying. And there's still a lot of studying and flying, right? Because you've got your checks and reviews and sim time and all that you've got to do. So it's quite a balancing act with you.
It's about finishing what you start. And that's what they want to see. People that are committed to finishing what you start. Because at the airlines, you have to be serious about what you do.
Yeah.
They have to know they're going to count on you to study when you're supposed to study, to know things, and to just be present and do the best that you can. This is not a career for slackers. You can be a reform slacker. You can learn.
I like that.
You can be a reform slacker. I'm one of them, you know, and well, I used to take it easy.
Yeah, aviation is also to some extent known as a place of refuge for people that didn't want to go to college, right? I'll go to flight school.
Place of refuge. That's
yeah. Funny. But then you find out, like, you know, okay, maybe you get through your private, but then that instrument hits, you're like, oh, I got to study, right? Or your commercial, definitely flight instructor and definitely ATP. By that point, it's a fire hose situation where you have to know how to study.
Well, it's funny what aviation does to us, and it's specifically to me, is I always was just a guy who did what it took to get by, but aviation has taught me how to be a student, how to be a professional, and has taught me discipline because I've studied since I was a student pilot. I remember the days that I would go to sleep with my books on the bed and wake up knowing I'm going to see the same books, and it was just in day and night. So it teaches you discipline. Aviation changes your personality, your traits. It really teaches you to be an adult because you're spending a lot of money and you're spending a lot of people's efforts. So you learn to get it together.
Yeah, it's a high level of responsibility. That's part and parcel of the job. I actually saw a great comedian the other day. I think it was on the Tonight Show. I'm going to have to find the clip and share it on the social for everybody. There's this comedian that says, you know, pilots never walk up as slackers. Like, you don't see a pilot like slouching in the lounge. Pilots are better than us. Like, it was just so hilarious. I was cracking up.
You reminded me of one that I saw, and I, for the life of me, cannot find this video again. And somebody shared it with me on WhatsApp, and it was about why he hates pilots. And it came along those lines because they're better than us. And all, you know, they're the only ones who can fly this machine and blah, blah, blah. Oh, man.
So we're kind of coming to the end of our hour. I'm kind of checking if we have much questions. We've had people visiting us from Barbados and India and Mongolia. Wow. Thank you for logging in. It's got to be like 1 a.m. over there, 2 a.m. Thank you for watching. We don't have a lot of questions, though. I think it's been very informative. How would people learn more about OBAP, or if they wanted to reach out to you? What's a good place for people to start?
Well, OBAP is easy. You go to obap.org. Oscar Bravo Alpha Papa. And there you can find out anything you want to about OBAP. We have programs mainly geared towards bringing people into STEM, catching them at a young age in high school, middle school, and elementary school. We have summer academies that are happening right now that we need volunteers for. They happen all around the country during the summer, about a year. You don't have to volunteer more than an hour if that's all you have. You can volunteer the full week, but our programs are geared towards getting people at a young age interested in some kind of STEM career. And if they have the interest, giving them professionals that will tell them anything they want to know. There's airport tours, there's games and all this stuff. And so that's our goal within OBAP. So if you go to obap.org, you can find out all about our programs and how to become a member. There are some advantages to being a member as well.
And for those of you that are not, you know, pilots at major airlines, OBAP is happy to have anybody, student pilots, even if you haven't started flying and you just like RC planes or you're like talking about airplanes, it's a great place to get a foot in the door, maybe get recommended to a flight school or an instructor or something like that. Again, mentorship is two parts. There's always the people like Captain Edwin here that are sharing their knowledge. And there's people that are there and ready to receive that knowledge, which is rare. A lot of people don't raise their hands and say like, I would like to talk to a captain.
Yeah. So one of the things that got me where I am is that I was fortunate enough to be such a talkative person that I met people that would give me advice. Otherwise, I would not have known anybody to give me advice. At OBAP, just like LPA, you can mingle with professionals. You can make friends with professionals in the field that you're interested in. So they become your mentors. They become your friends and you guys learn from each other. That's one of the benefits of joining one of these two organizations. Latino Pilots Association is the other one. That one is more young. So they're making a lot of headways lately. It's amazing what they're establishing. I would tell anybody that's interested in any aviation career to look into these two because you don't have to be a pilot. OBAP has a big push to get people from all aviation careers, not only the mechanics, not only the pilots, but also operations, HR, everything that we call aviation aerospace. They want us in there. Yeah. And you can find people to help you with any decision you have to make or questions you want to make. So that's the major benefit of these two organizations, making friends with professionals and having mentors to help you through anything, talk you through it, answer your questions, and even find out if this is going to be for you or not. So we don't see anything. We're not on the clock ever. You can call me anytime and I'll be like, yeah, let's talk about this or that. You know, that's what we do as mentors.
Yeah, that's excellent. That's excellent. So if I had to recap our conversation today, it's that, you know, get out there, volunteer, get to know people, right? It's that aviation is a winding road. You've got to put yourself out there. If it's not the moment, it's your moment, right? And you've got to make the most of it. You know, whatever job that is, hanging out at the FBO, always have a resume in your pocket. You never know who you're going to meet. It's absolutely true. You never know who you're going to meet.
Yeah.
It sounds like some of the biggest breaks that happened in your life were like just a casual conversation while you're doing something else.
Well, going back to what you said, you know, having a resume in hand, you really got to learn to put yourself out there. If you're not going to have a set path, such as going regionals where you kind of know what's going to happen, when it's going to happen, you really have to be a go-getter, go out there and chase it. One of those things is networking by sitting at an FBO. Sure. And saying hi to people and asking them about their airplanes and giving them resumes, laying the groundwork because years on, this will pay dividends.
Yeah. You know, we've actually had two questions come in just the last little bit. Jack wants to know how much you had to invest in your into your career to make it to the airlines as a first officer. That's a hard one to quantify.
Well, I'm guessing they're speaking about money.
Yeah.
How much I've trained students from zero to commercial that only spent about 30 to 40 grand. US dollars. Mm-hmm. And I myself spend a lot more than that. Mm-hmm. So you can go anywhere from there to the limit.
That's a good point. You know, our program is the base is 37 and most people usually end up in the 40s once you tack on, you know, a multi-engine or a CFI program or things like that. But it's, I think it's gotten more accessible. You're getting a lot of value for that. On the other hand, there's wonderful programs like Embry-Riddle that are $150,000, you know, five times as much. You get that four-year degree you were talking about, but ultimately you have the same pilot's license. So there's different levels for where you kind of insert yourself into the process of becoming pilots. I'd say you dedicated something like 15 years of your life, it sounds like, until you got to United, right, as a first
officer. Yeah, I started training in 2001, and I was hired in 2016, yeah.
Yeah.
15 years. And they go by in a breeze. So to this person asking the question, explore. I'm sure there's a low-cost university or college in Barbados somewhere. Yeah. Was that the Barbados?
Well, that was somebody above, but yes.
Oh, okay. So, you know, if money is your concern, first of all, look to see what you have around you. Community college? Is there a small flight school? Okay, start out. Just basically get started. Because I remember being in this phase. When you think about it too much, you think, oh, wow, this is a daunting task. I can't do it. And you never do. So start out. Go to a college. Sign up for a degree course and start studying.
Yeah. And I would also say start small. To Conroy in Barbados, 15 years old. It's refreshing to see somebody with that clarity vision of what they want to be at that age, right? Start with hobby groups at that age, right? Like, is there in Barbados, is there an aero club? Is there an RC club? Is there now on the internet, there's lots of simulator clubs. I see people flying simulators, network simulators all the time. It's never been easier to take classes online either, theory-wise, right? That doesn't mean you're going to come out with a pilot certificate just because you took classes online. It's a great way to get your head into it.
I put in there our email because this is a OBAP's Aerospace Professional Development Program. And it's where we get in touch with young men like this and professionals of my age. And we guide them through any questions they have. So we can definitely dedicate more time to them through that avenue. And what I would say to them, you know, you're 15 years old. Say it now. Say it aloud to your parents and friends. Buy me a Discovery Flight.
Discovery Flight's a great place to start.
Buy me a Discovery Flight. It's cheaper than a regular 1 hour lesson and get out there and see if it's for you. Cause I'm sure it'll be, And then your parents and then everybody around you will know that you're serious about this. So, hey, everything will start coming together, but just explore your curiosity through a discovery flight.
Yeah. And that 1 hour flight, you're going to know if you love it or hate it. Mm-hmm. And, usually you can take along a parent or a sibling with you to kind of share that experience with them. Because part of it's convincing mom and dad too, right? Your main sponsors and probably all of your aunts and uncles to get that ride.
To them, you know, I don't want to give out my email or anything, but write to them and ask them for me. And I'll answer any questions they have offline. Mm-hmm. I'll be glad to email or correspond with them on phone. And the good thing about OBAP and LPA is you get people who are members from all these different countries, and they still have roots in these countries. So even though there's something that you don't know about, this person could, mm-hmm. and they get you connected with them. So it's all part of your network that you're going to develop.
Absolutely. I can think of one pilot right now from Barbados who flew with us for years, senior instructor, and now he's flying charters through the islands. So you can do it in Barbados. You can do it mm-hmm. in Trinidad and Guyana, throughout the Caribbean. We have a ton of Caribbean students that are here. And yeah, it takes time. It takes effort. But if you have your mindset to it now, you will get there.
Yeah, remember, no situation is permanent. Right now, things are closed because of COVID. But guess what? It's not going to be like this in 5 years. It's not going to be like this when you graduate high school. Trust me. Things will be different. So as long as you just dig and keep digging and looking, you'll find something. And there will be solutions because nothing stays the same forever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you said there's an aero club. This is closed because of COVID, but I'm sure they'll reopen soon. And those people, even though they're closed, are still there in Barbados.
Yeah.
So knock on the door. Maybe the club's not open, but somebody you can talk to over there.
Somebody's got to turn on the lights, right, at the club.
Absolutely. And I see that a lot from our students in the islands. They get their private, or maybe at least they get a discovery flight, and then they come over to the U.S. to learn how to fly with us because we've got the infrastructure to do it. But Edwin, we're coming to the end of our hour. I just want to thank you so much for giving us your time and your story. To everybody that's watching Facebook and in the Zoom, please like and subscribe. You can find these videos on Facebook, YouTube, and our podcasts on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Visit wayman.edu, our main sponsor, where I'm standing today. 141 Flight Academy here in Miami with 42 airplanes launching thousands of pilots around the world. Join us. We are authorized for international M1 visas and everything from your first flight all the way through commercial pilot and our 5 airline partners. Edwin, thank you so much for giving me your time this afternoon. Thank you so much.
Thanks. I appreciate the invitation, and bye, everybody.
Bye. Keep the blue side up.
Okay.
This series is brought to you by Wayman Aviation Academy. Learn to fly with a safe, reliable, professional academy located between Miami and Fort Lauderdale in sunny South Florida, USA. Enjoy the training and cosmopolitan life with Wayman's 42 aircraft, 6 airline partners, and 2 bases to help you be the captain.